Okay, the title of my presentation is The Longitudinal Health and Intellectual Study, which we refer to under the acronym LIDS, and we're really looking at trying to identify the health and health risk behaviors of adults with intellectual disabilities. And I have my colleague in the audience, Dr. Kelly Shea, who's the epidemiologist and research methodologist on the study. Also like to thank Special Olympics. They partially funded the study. Steve Corbin's in the audience, so special thanks in terms of our data collection procedures. We did a lot of it at the Special Olympics Games, which was very helpful. I have no relationships to disclose. And in this particular study today, I'd like to go over a number of things. Again, it's a longitudinal study, so we're presenting this data on a regular basis. We presented some of it in May at the State of the Science Conference for the Rehabilitation Research and Training Center on Health and Intellectual Disabilities. This particular study has an additional 600 participants, so in May we presented data on approximately 890. Now we're over 1,500, and you'll see the data set in a few moments. So the aims of this study, again, the focus being a longitudinal data set that can identify changes across time, examine the impact of baseline musculoskeletal biomarkers across time on health. We won't talk about that today. Kelly, Dr. Shea's study is looking at the risk of falls in adults with ID, so she's got a separate study, sub-study underneath this one addressing falls in adults with ID. And we're also looking at examining the impact of health behavior changes across time on psychological well-being and community participation. So there are several studies like this in the literature. One of them, probably the most popular one, is the longitudinal study done at Framingham, Massachusetts, called the Framingham Heart Study. And a lot of the information on cardiovascular risk factors actually was identified from that study, where they monitored blood pressure and cholesterol of people who lived in that community for many, many years. This study went on for probably 50 years, and I think it's still continuing today. And we gained a lot of information about tracking the same people across time in order to establish causation with certain health behaviors and health risk indicators. Nurses' health study is also a very popular one. We work on our project with a consultant who's the lead investigator on the nurses' health study, Dr. Ayman Lee. She's been very helpful in terms of the design of this study. She's an epidemiologist and a world-class researcher in the area of physical activity and health. Physicians' health study, national longitudinal study of adolescent health, health and retirement study, and the national children's study are examples of longitudinal studies addressing health. In terms of the background of our study, we did search the literature to ensure that we weren't overlapping or replicating studies that were already ongoing. One of them being the National Core Indicator Study, which is a very large cross-sectional study addressing core indicators in adults with ID across the nation. The current set of performance indicators includes approximately 100 items or indicators for consumers, families, systemic questions, cost, and health and safety outcomes. The second longitudinal study that is ongoing, we call it cross-sectional here, but I think they're also trying to get at the same participant over time, is the Pomona study, which is tracking 18 health indicators in 14 European countries. So just a couple of differences between the two data sets. Again, you can see that National Core Indicators is addressing certain areas of health, healthcare access, for example, health conditions, moderate physical activity, smoking incidents, social participation, employment, and caregiver information. Our study does a deeper dive where we're actually getting into certain things like health-related quality of life, health conditions, physical function, certain items related to healthcare access, different types of insurance programs, health behaviors. We look at moderate, but we also ask questions related to vigorous physical activity, weight control items, diet, smoking, alcohol, oral hygiene, and social participation, employment, and day services, and caregiver information. So some overlap, but the questions are quite different. And our questions, again, have a little bit more precision associated with the items that we're examining. So the research questions are, first set of research questions relates to chronic health conditions in adults with ID, and we wanted to address what are the top five chronic health conditions. You'll actually see this morning the top 10. The second item is related to obesity. That's an area of interest of mine and has been for over 25 years. And we did work in the early 1990s where we started to identify rates of obesity being significantly different based on living arrangements. So we've kind of now revitalized that research. Living arrangements have changed markedly over the last 20 years in people with intellectual disabilities, and we wanted to be able to track this. The interesting element about this is that it provides rich data for the general set of researchers who are addressing issues associated with obesity in the built environment. We've got very different living arrangements, as you'll see in a moment. And then also addressing the area of health risk behaviors. So for today, we're going to be really addressing this cross-sectional data set that we have. We're in the process of collecting the second year data set. So we have a mixed modes data collection where we have a paper and an online version of the survey. And there are three sections. It's broken out by health and function, health behaviors, and socio-demographics. And in total, there are about 120 items. It takes approximately 30 minutes to complete. In terms of data collection, we began in 2009. We currently have in 2010 2,841 surveys were sent out, 2,182 on paper, and 659 online. We had a return rate of 1,615 surveys, which is 55 to 60% return rate, 1,179 in paper, and 436 online. And we're in the current year two of data collection. And we begin, data collection year three in 2012 and move on to 2013 with year four. So in terms of the results, the demographics look, not anything unusual that you haven't seen in the past. In terms of age, the majority of participants were in the age group of 18 to 44. The next highest sample was the group 27% of the sample fell into the 65-year-old age group, and then a smaller percentage in those over 65. Race, the majority were white, 89%, 6% black, smaller percentage of Hispanic and other, which included Native Americans, Pacific Islanders. Diagnostic conditions, we had about one out of every two had intellectual disability only, 25% had Down syndrome, 12% cerebral palsy, 11% autism, and 6% reported other. Now keep in mind that these categories here, autism, cerebral palsy, Downs, and other, also had an intellectual disability. So this was, the 46% was intellectual disability only. In terms of the employment status, 6 out of 10 were employed, 61% were employed, and 39% reported that they had no employment. Level of intellectual disability, a broad range from borderline, 13%, 32% reported mild intellectual disability, 24% moderate, 6% severe, 3% profound, and we had 22% who did not report level of ID, but again, responded to the survey because they had a child or an individual in their family who had an intellectual disability. Living arrangements, 55% of the participants lived with their family or relative, 13% lived on their own, 5% lived in what we call a host family or a foster home. It's an interesting dynamic that we discussed when we were preparing for this presentation. Some have live in a foster family with just one child that has an intellectual disability, and others up to perhaps four or five children live in what they also call foster care. So that could be quite interesting in terms of analyzing differences between one or more children with an intellectual disability. Supported living, which is usually a small set of adults with ID living together in an apartment type of setting, 15%, 9% group home, and 3% in a larger facility. Now, if you would have looked at this chart 20 years ago when we did this, the larger facility would have had, probably 20 to 25% of the participants living in that setting. So we're no longer seeing, thank heavens, the institutional setting being, where a large percentage of adults with intellectual disabilities live. We're starting to use this term called COLA. We're not getting any funding, by the way, from the Coca-Cola company. It just works well with continuum of living arrangements. So we have, we're trying to put this into a framework. This is all, at this point, subjective, from most supervised settings to least supervised, group home, supported living, host family, family, relative, and live on their own. So when we say least supervised, we don't mean least restrictive. We mean that there's probably, at some point, when they live on their own, they're not getting as much support or coaching from a family member or from some organization that's responsible for direct care, where they have to report back to a state agency on the health or the participation of certain types of behaviors of adults with IBD. So that's kind of our working model for now, and we'd love to hear more from you in terms of that looks right. In terms of the prevalence of chronic health conditions, again, number one, this is a BMI of over 30 kilograms per meter squared. About 4 out of 10 adults with ID had obesity. The number two condition was seizure disorders. 3 was anxiety. 4 depression. 5 thyroid. 6 high blood cholesterol. 7 high blood pressure. 8 constipation. 9 heartburn, acid reflux. And 10 attention deficit disorder. Now, it's interesting to see that 2 of the 5 conditions are mental health in the first 5. So anxiety and depression were ranked third and fourth out of these top 5 conditions. Of course, obesity was number 1. Obesity among adults with ID by living arrangement, not a great deal of difference, except we did see a slightly higher rate in the population of supported living and those living on their own. This actually turned out to be significantly higher compared to the other 3 settings. Seizure disorder among adults with ID by living arrangements, not sure why, but again, there were differences in different settings. So the host family, foster care, had the highest incidence of adults with ID reported seizure disorders. And the lowest setting was when they lived on their own. That might be related, again, to if they have seizure disorders, they may not have the opportunity to live on their own because of the risk involved with that condition. Anxiety disorder, this is interesting. Again, I think to start to zero in and drill down much deeper into our data in future studies, group home had the highest rate of anxiety disorders, and it was significantly different, significantly higher. And when we looked at depression, it was the same situation, 29.2%. The highest rate were in the group, living in the group home setting, and that once again came out significantly higher than the other settings. So I did have some interactions with a couple of managed care organizations about this, and there is some speculation that living in large congregate facilities like a group home where you have to share things and there's issues associated with use of facilities and food is also an issue in those kind of settings, you know, could create a lot of stress. Because I kept thinking, you know, I made this general statement, I'm not sure why anxiety and depression have come up as the 2 highest conditions when you would think, you know, people with intellectual disabilities are provided good care, they have opportunities to participate in health and recreation. And somebody raised their hand in the audience, he said, have you ever lived in a setting with 15 other adults where there's food gouging and, you know, sometimes, you know, a lot of antagonism about who uses this and you took that. So it is a tough situation at this point. We don't know very much more about it. It used to be the gold standard, living in those kind of settings. Thyroid disorder, again, significantly different. Also higher in the population with the host family foster care. Now, in terms of the number of chronic health conditions, for the remainder of the presentation, I was going to zero in on a couple of things. One is this particular group who has 5 or more chronic health conditions, and that 27.6%, which is relatively high, of the sample actually has 5 or more of these chronic health conditions that I described. So if we take a look at this group, what you see is that the number one issue is obesity in this group, and then followed by depression, anxiety, heartburn, acid reflux, and constipation are the type 5 conditions in those who have 5 or more chronic health conditions. And lower on the scale, high blood cholesterol, high blood pressure, hip, knee pain, and arthritis popped up when we started to look at this group. In terms of obesity, I presented this earlier, and it didn't change from the May data, again, with an additional approximately 600 adults. But again, you can see, just to point out, that what is really concerning in this chart are the females are 67% higher in terms of their obesity rate compared to data that we used from the National Health Interview Survey. So we've heard this before, that females with intellectual disabilities seem to have a significantly higher rate of obesity than males. And you can see it's not as different. Males are still higher than non-ID males, but not as much. Prevalence of morbid obesity is also a big concern as we start to think about clinical implications and clinical research. We've really got to begin to address this issue of a significantly higher rate of females. 10.9% have morbid obesity compared to 7.2% for females without ID. Tracking prevalence of obesity by living arrangement, again, not a whole lot of difference, except we did see in females living in supported living settings, 1 of every 2 was obese compared to a few of the other settings that we compared it to. And it does jump around and seems to drop a little bit in those living on their own compared to some of the other settings. Now, this is probably the most interesting slide, and it shows you prevalence of chronic health conditions by obesity status. And what is absolutely amazing about this is that if you look at these 10 conditions, 11 conditions, 10 of the 11 conditions were significantly higher when you collapse the groups by sex between those who were obese and non-obese. So in other words, those who had high blood pressure, females, 17% who were obese had high blood pressure compared to 8.9% of the non-obese group. High cholesterol, 19.1% of females with obesity had high cholesterol versus 10.2%. And if you go down the list, it's like that for 10 of the 11 conditions. 7.3% of those with bipolar had obesity versus 3.8% of those who are non-obese. Now, in terms of weight control decision, this is new data that we haven't presented yet. Weight control decisions by BMI, weight status, trying to lose weight. Those who were obese, 60.6% were trying to lose weight. Then you can see 35.5% who were listed as overweight, normal, and underweight. But still, those who are obese, if you only have 60.6 trying to lose weight, that's data, again, that has to be mined to determine how this is occurring. But what's more surprising is that 22.3% of those who are obese are really not doing anything about it, and we're not quite sure if that has any implications for future intervention work. How are they controlling their weight when they are doing so? 77% are using diet with obesity, and 61.6% are using exercise, behavioral counseling, a little bit less. Health professional recommendations by overweight obesity status. Those who are obese advised to maintain weight, 5.5%, we're not sure why. Those advised to lose weight, 51.5%. And given no evidence or no advice, which is pretty high, 42% were not given any advice by the physicians to lose weight. Health risk behaviors by living arrangements. I'm running out of time, so I can't go through this, but there are, I wanted to emphasize that when you look at these two settings with family and living on their own, the circled items are showing that there's a greater health risk behavior, that the health risk behavior that we've identified, are much higher in these two settings, living on their own and living with family, higher rate of watching TV, lower intake of fruit and vegetables, more fast food usage, and so on and so forth. So again, it's showing you that by living arrangements, there are different things. In conclusion, obesity is a much greater health disparity among adults with ID compared to the general population, nothing new there. The prevalence of morbid obesity is significantly higher in females with ID compared to men with ID and females in the general population. That's of concern, something we need to begin to look at. In certain subgroups, such as women, individuals with Down syndrome, and adults residing in less restrictive settings, it is even a substantially greater problem. And finally, obesity and certain chronic conditions are more prevalent in subgroups, having higher rates of health risk behaviors. And in the future, we certainly need more clarity on these health risk behaviors. We need to continue to look at this longitudinally. And certainly, living arrangements seems to have a dramatic effect on certain health outcomes. I'd like to thank, my co-investigator, Dr. Kelly Chier, and the funding we received from the RRTC on Aging with Intellectual Developmental Disability, Lifespan, Health and Function. The PI is Dr. Tamar Heller, who many of you may know, and also some of the work we're doing in the National Center on Physical Activity and Disability. And we're funded by the Department of Education, the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research. Thank you.